This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Americans put in longer hours than workers in any other industrial country in the world. Since September 11th, some people's work has been given newfound importance, while others are questioning what they do for a living and seeking out new careers. Tonight, a look at changing attitudes toward the work we do post 9/11. We begin the hour, though, with a check-in on the federal government's September 11 fund for families of those who died in last fall's attacks. Tonight, survivors are gathering at a rally in New York City to protest what they say are the fund's unfair rules and insufficient compensation. I spoke with William Sherman, a reporter with the New York Daily News. I asked him about the major grievances that will be raised at the rally tonight.
Well, there are several major grievances. One is, Senator Clinton mentioned, the feeling that some families will be penalized because they have 401k accounts or IRA accounts, life insurance, other kinds of investments that will be deducted from the amount they would get from the special fund. What's interesting is this is cross-party lines. You have Governor Pataki, who's a Republican, and Hillary Clinton, who's a Democrat.
Both criticizing or both?
Both criticizing.
William Sherman, what's the basic benefit that survivors are receiving under the draft proposal?
Well, from Kenneth Feinberg's point of view, and Kenneth Feinberg is the special master in charge, the benefits are the following. If they go to court to file a wrongful death suit, which, of course, they have the right to, typically it would take 5 or 6 years to resolve that suit. That's A. Second, somebody who goes to court as opposed to going to the fund, if you will, has to prove liability on the part of the airlines or another defendant. In other words, they would have to convince a judge and jury that the airlines could have prevented this.
So it's an arduous process.
Right. And then the next question is, will there be enough money in the pot, considering all the different corporations, insurance companies, reinsurers, will there be enough left for the victims' families?
So the government is instead offering cash now or soon.
Within 120 days.
And what exactly is the government offering?
They are offering everybody a flat cap, if you will, of $250,000 for pain and suffering. That includes the pain and suffering of the victim, if you will, and the pain and suffering of the families.
And then is there additional money for the number of children you have or the size of income that the victim had?
Basically, it looks like a chart. On the non-economic losses, which are pain and suffering, there's a cap so far. This could change. And on the economic damages, if you will, it gets a little complicated, but it's pretty much how much you've been making over the last couple of years and projections of how much you would have made in the future during your working life expectancy, which typically ends when you're 65.
Is there a range then that's been set out there, the least you might get on that score and the most one family might get?
Yes. And one of the problems, those in opposition to the plan are saying that the way the formula works, it is presumed that the most anybody earned was $250,000 here, while we know that's not true.
William Sherman, is this the tone of the argument? I mean, it's starting to sound like actuarial tables and the disability insurance, but this
exactly
is really, that's not what this is it? Isn't it, in some sense, symbolic compensation for this loss?
It is. And the I should say that the average payment for the victim's family is $1.6 million. It's being done in part because of the what they call the Airline Stabilization Act, where, in essence, the government capped the airline's liability to the amount of insurance carried by each specific flight that was crashed.
Right. But where do New Yorkers stand on this? They've seen this whole tragedy unfold. Are New Yorkers behind the complaints of these survivors who are complaining?
I think they're divided, but I think a lot of them are behind the complaints. For example, Representative Carolyn Maloney noted the survivors of a woman who died will get less given the same other criteria than a man, because it was determined that women have a shorter work-life expectancy than men. I mean, other New Yorkers think, look, this is very generous. I mean, these families are getting, you know, $1.6 million each. You know, does that happen in a highway accident?
How many people can afford to carry that much life insurance?
Right. But that is one of the big issues, is life insurance. You know, if I just decided to take out life insurance and you, for example, didn't, why should life insurance be deducted from my payment why should you get more than me simply because I decided to take out a life insurance policy?
On the other hand, I suppose it could be argued this is not to make people rich. This is just to be sure that they're as okay can be after such a tragedy.
The other side of that is you could say that with an average of $1.6 million tax-free, yes, nobody will become terribly rich. But then again, yes, in your words, they will be okay.
William Sherman is a reporter with the New York Daily News. Americans work hard and long. Our jobs shape our lives. Since the events of September 11th, many Americans have begun reevaluating what they do for a living. Some have found a new importance in their careers, while others have suddenly found their work unfulfilling and have leapt to other professions. For some, work has taken a backseat to family and loved ones. For others, work has a new significance and urgency. With a war on terror, a full-blown recession, and layoffs all over, Americans are reconsidering work. This hour, we're taking a look at work and careers post-9/11. Has your work taken on new importance, or are the events of September 11th pushing you to do something new for a living? Are you finding your inner fireman, teacher, AmeriCorps volunteer, or sticking with the job you've got? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now in the studio is Howard Gardner. He's a professor of cognition and education at Harvard's Graduate School of Education and adjunct professor of neurology at the Boston University School of Medicine. He's also co-author of a new book called Good Work, When Excellence and Ethics Meet, and the director of the Good Work Project, which has looked at 12 different professions across age, gender, and ethnicity to ask what constitutes good work. Good evening and welcome, Howard Gardner.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
Also joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Howard Gardner, you've looked at contemporary American attitudes toward work. You looked at them before September 11th. What did you see evolving when you looked out last year and in recent years as you did your survey? And how do you think these attitudes may have changed since 9/11?
We were very interested in the extent to which people who work in different professions feel aligned. And aligned is a word that we came up with to indicate that...
Aligned sounds like yoga or something.
indicate that people are doing what they think is important, and they find the other people around them, whether it's their colleagues, mm-hmm. the general public, shareholders if they're doing a publicly traded company, also support them. And under those conditions, it's easy to do good work, which we call work that's both good in quality but also is ethical, responsible, and so on. And the two professions which we focused on in our book, Good Work, turn out to be very interesting in the post-September 11th mm-hmm. Context.
And they were?
Genetics and journalism.
Well, that's two opposite directions.
Well, we looked at genetics and journalism because we said these are two professions which are tremendously important. Mm-hmm. Briefly, journalists tell us what's going on in the world. They fill our minds with what we call memes, different ideas. Mm-hmm. Genetics, of course, tells us about what's going to happen to our bodies. And more nowadays, geneticists don't merely describe, but they are involved in therapy, cloning experiments. Mm-hmm. And it turned out, using our terminology, that genetics was a very well-aligned field. Most geneticists loved what they were doing, felt they could do whatever they wanted to, and it would be considered to be right. They were all trying to help us live longer, be healthier, and everybody was saying, go for it.
So by your measure, they were aligned, meaning it was challenging work, plus they saw it as being beneficial for society and themselves or something like that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Your trade, that of journalists, were very unhappy, frustrated group.
Oh, dear.
By and large, people go into journalism because they want to describe what's happening in the world. They want to do it in a fair way. Of course, they want to get attention for what they're describing. They want to have time to research it fully and to make sure that they get the story right.
So what was the problem?
The problem, which is probably somewhat more acute in broadcast than in print, but it's across journalism, is people felt that there wasn't time to get the job done. There was such tremendous pressures to get things out right away. And market forces, which determine how much money the outlet makes, really become determinant. So the phrase on broadcast, if it bleeds, it leads. People felt they didn't have time to do investigative reporting. They didn't have time to do due diligence. In fact, with the internet shooting stories out every minute, they had to get stuff out very fast. They had to cut corners. And many people were thinking of leaving journalism. About a third of the people we spoke to wanted to get out of the profession, whereas in genetics, we almost never came into anybody in contact with anybody who just didn't want to do it as long as he or she could.
You're cutting awfully close to home here tonight, Howard Gardner, but we want to use these and your whole idea of good work and aligned work as a kind of, as models for thinking about all kinds of work, because, you know, people's jobs are all over the place. A small fraction of us are geneticists and journalists, but everybody's got work. Everyone's thinking about its meaning. So I'm hearing you say that Americans have been looking, wishing, or at least they're happier when their work lines up with the actual satisfaction of the activity and a kind of an ethical contribution to society. Do you have a sense of, across society, beyond these two professions you've mentioned, or these two occupations anyway, of how Americans more generally felt about work and how that may be changing now?
Well, let me stick to journalism and genetics for one more minute.
All right.
Because in the book, we speculated that all alignment was temporary. We talked about journalism as having been highly aligned in the area around 1950, the time of CBS News, mm-hmm. the loose publications like Time, Life, Saturday Evening Post, and so on. And physics had been tremendously well aligned during the time of Einstein and Heisenberg going into the Manhattan Project, and it suddenly became misaligned after the Second World War when mm-hmm. the physicists lost control of what was happening to their invention.
So events and history can shape whether or not people feel aligned with their work.
Exactly. And once September 11th occurred, it was very clear to me and to my colleagues that both of the fields that we looked at, the alignment had actually changed. Journalism instantly became much better aligned because people cared about what was on newspapers. Mm-hmm. They cared what was being broadcast. They wanted to get things right.
I think we all feel this around here at WBUR, certainly.
Well, your program is an instance of it. Mm-hmm. It came together very, very quickly. The downside of in journalism is that it's been very, very costly. A few months ago, I read an estimate that the major news outlets had lost $100 million just in regular operating expenses. They had to spend $100 million more, and $500 million were lost in advertising revenue. And this was as of November, so you can double it now in January. The question, of course, is in a highly market-driven economy, how long can the New York Times put out a section called A Nation Challenged with no photographs, 6-10 pages a day?
No ads, you mean to say.
Sorry. Plus due diligence in those wonderful descriptions of the people who died. I mean, this is a tremendous amount of expense.
And, of course, this applies to NPR as well. Public radio listeners, reach for your checkbooks now.
Right. In the case of genetics, there was, of course, no direct attack on genetics, but there was going to be much less money available for pure research. And the research that in which venture capital go is likely to be research that's very much targeted to bioterror, to anthrax understanding, mm-hmm. and the kind of excitement that the Nobel Prize-seeking geneticist has to look at exactly what he wants to, what she wants to, and the way they want to. That's also disappearing.
It's possible that they might move a bit out of alignment as journalists have moved a bit more into alignment with job satisfaction.
Right. The more general question you were raising is how were people before September 11th and how were they after September 11th? I think the most important thing to say about before September 11th is just about everybody whom we spoke to, and we looked at fields ranging from theater to higher education to philanthropy to the law, feels tremendously under the gun because of the power of the market. The market's always been powerful in the United States, but there have been other forces, religious forces, ideological forces, community forces, which tended to mitigate against the market being so all-powerful.
And now under the gun in what sense? What was the material evidence?
Well, let's take museums for an example. I mean, America has had museums for long periods of time, and they stayed in business without that much trouble. But in the last 10, 15 years, museums have become more and more dependent on what are called blockbuster exhibitions. They raise huge amounts of money to put these on. They try to shove as many people in the museum. Many of us have had this kind of experience. And the claim is that unless they have these blockbuster museums, they won't be able to put things on that they, quote unquote, they really want to put on. Uh-huh. But often there's no time or energy to put on what they really want to put on. And we know that in museums, more and more, it's the gift shop and the restaurant which is taking over. And often people don't even have a chance to go and to take a look at the most recent exhibition which a scholarly curator put forth.
So it's up or out, and the economic pressures are forcing people to look at their jobs in a way they may not want to. We're going to talk after the break about how 9/11 9/11 may be shading the world of work. What about you? How are you looking at your work, your career, post 9/11? Have your values changed, your priorities? Are you considering a career change? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're joined tonight by Howard Gardner. He's co-author of Good Work When Excellence and Ethics Meet. And we're talking about careers, jobs, your job, your work post 9/11. Has its significance changed to you? Does it bring you more satisfaction today or less? Does it still look relevant? Does it look important? Are you thinking about changing careers? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. Howard Gardner, what about post 9/11? How do you feel the atmosphere changing around work? What kinds of careers or individual careers have been raised in public esteem, somehow more attractive, more aligned with the times, if you will? And what kinds may have a little less altitude now?
There's a lot of evidence that the notion of public service has become much, much more important. Not only is there greater respect for people in government and people who do other kinds of things where they risk their lives for their country, but many more younger people want to go into the military, into ROTC. I heard today that there's a 30% increase in the number of students who want to do voluntary national service. That's a staggering increase just in the case of a few months.
It's huge.
Yeah. As you said in your introduction, people who were oriented only toward money, toward going to Wall Street and making as much money as quickly as possible, being involved, let's say, in venture capital, are giving some second thoughts to that. Business school has not seen a huge increase. In law school, what I understand is that there's a lot more interest in public interest law and also working with people who are indigent and who can't afford to pay for their own kind of care. There also is, I think, the two other things that we have to talk about. Certain professions have been very much pressured. People who are in the airline industry have had a terrible time. Mm. One estimate I read said a third of the people in the hotel industry may lose their jobs.
Wow.
There's certain industries that have gotten very much squeezed. On the other hand, if you're in the security industry, if you're in the intelligence industry.
That's security, not securities this time.
Correct. And even if you're somebody who's, for example, an expert in languages or Islamic societies, you'll be very much at a premium now. In fact, a number of foundations have decided to start programs, or at least to start to fund research in areas which have to do with parts of the world about which we've been woefully ignorant, the billion or so people who are Islamic, people from the Middle East, and so on. But most of us are in our jobs. Most of us are lucky enough not to have lost them. And so the question is, day in and day out, has that changed? And my impression is that most people are taking their work more seriously.
Hmm.
They're thinking a lot more about the mission. What are they trying to do?
Mm-hmm.
What are they trying to accomplish? Are they going about it in the right way? They're thinking a lot more about role models. Whom do they admire? Whom do they really want to be like? I'm a doctor. I'm a lawyer. I'm an accountant. Accountant being a very loaded word these days.
Just now.
Whom do I admire and who do I look down upon? And then what in our book Good Work we call the mirror test. When you look at yourself in the mirror, are you proud of what you see? Are you the kind of worker that you want to be? If everybody was the kind of worker that you were, if everybody were the kind of salesman or person who's working in a restaurant or a person who's in a foundry or a person who's a custodian or a person who's in the military, are you the kind of person that other people would say that person's a good worker? Mm-hmm. How long that will last, very, very hard to say, but it certainly has lasted until now.
Listeners, what about it? When you look at the mirror, in the mirror, post 9/11, what do you see in terms of your career profile, in terms of the work you do? Is it as satisfying as it ever was, more satisfying or less? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty, my wise friend, you've been around the block through a couple of cycles. Have you perceived cycles, the rise and fall of different kinds of work in public esteem and satisfaction to the people who carry them out? Do you have a sense of that over time?
Well, just take journalism, which is one of Howard's subjects here, one of the focuses of his book. Around the time of Watergate, the journalist as investigative reporter, the journalist as a sort of key player in democracy, the journalist bringing down the president. It was a very, it became a very attractive profession people who want to really affect history.
Mm-hmm.
And Woodward and Bernstein became sort of models for a generation of journalists.
Gods.
Gods, but you know, really sort of what happened to them is kind of what happened to the profession.
Mm.
I mean, they became personages. They became celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
They became, you know, buck rollers, whatever they call it, buck rakers. You know, you give a speech, you get $30,000. And the, you know, journalists went from sort of reporting on elites to being elites themselves.
Mm.
And I think this resulted in a lot of self-disgust among journalists. And you could see it really in their distance from some of the things that the country was into. For example, although journalists in polls are much more liberal than the norm mm. on social issues, mm. abortion, gay rights, and so on, they're rather Tory on economic issues, especially anything to do with trade. I mean, free trade is that's the gospel. And but of course, if you do polls of Americans, they think it's actually morally more desirable to buy an American product because it's made by American workers. And this disconnect, I think, this class disconnect from the basic core economic issues of people earning their living has colored journalism in my time and has made the journalist less and less relevant to the urgent problems confronting ordinary American working people.
Mm.
And I think that is the biggest change. In a way, it's a kind of you know, gentrification of the profession has been one of the dominant changes in the time I've been in it.
There's Jack Beatty on journalism. What about you and your job in your career? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. How is your sense of your own work and its worth and its satisfaction to you, its utility to society changed post 9/11? Jen is on the line. Welcome, Jen. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
I was just calling to comment. I worked in a industry, sort of corporate marketing.
Okay.
And I was a creative director for that company.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, with the economic downturn, we would put on various corporate events and people flying all over the country to attend product launches and whatnot. And so
that's not quite so popular anymore, is it, Jen?
No, it's not. And they started laying off people in May. And
mm-hmm.
and then, so there were a couple of rounds of layoffs. And then following 9/11, immediately millions upon millions of dollars were lost.
Right.
And they...
So the economy may have changed your working life pretty immediately there.
So I was laid off in November,
mm-hmm.
And right out of college, gosh, in 96, I sort of had considered going into the Peace Corps, and then because of student loans and everything else, I said, well, you know what, I'll get out there, it'll work a couple years.
Right.
And it's funny, because I'd always been sort of a little apologetic and sort of self-conscious of this sort of, I don't want to say frivolous, but definitely, you know, I would write executive speeches and commercials. And
sure, but still corporate marketing didn't sound like the Peace Corps.
No. So here I am, and I'm, you know, looking for a job like mad. But I also just last night went to an information session on about the Peace Corps. And
do you think that's about 9/11, or is it just about finding a way out of a desert economy?
I think 9/11 definitely made me face up to what I'd sort of always questioned
mm-hmm.
anyway about
mm-hmm.
what I was doing. And just really that need and that sort of yearning to make a difference in some small, minute way.
In some corner of the world.
And yeah, and that's, you know, one of the things they told us last night was, you know, it's very small, day-by-day change. And you're not mm-hmm. going to see anything dramatic happen if you're, you know, off in some corner of the world. But that, you know, it's a process, and I think that little bit of good in the end makes a difference to this larger whole that, you know, we all want to be a peaceful place. So,
absolutely. Jen, thank you very much for your story. Thanks for calling. Howard Gardner, what do you hear in this? Is this an evolution of attitude toward work that you have seen, particularly post 9/11?
I think it's quite wonderful. One of my heroes is Jean Monnet, who was the person who had the idea for the European Union
mm-hmm.
60 or 70
mm-hmm.
years ago. And Monnet said something that really influenced me. He said, I regard every defeat as an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Jen lost her job. Mm-hmm. Nobody likes that. She could either sulk about it, try very hard just to do the same thing and pretend that nothing had happened, or use this as a chance to explore possibilities which she might not have otherwise. And the wonderful thing about the United States as opposed to a more totalitarian country is we do have the option to go to almost any job that we're qualified for, that we aren't cut off because of who our parents were or because of what union we belong to.
Praise the Lord.
Right. And I think it would be terrific for Jen to go into Peace Corps, do some other kind of service job for a while. It doesn't have to be her life's work, but she'll just have a much, much better understanding of what's happening in the world. And I think we'll be able to affect people with a kind of authority that, to be honest, she probably wouldn't be able to continue doing if she had just remained as a corporate marketer.
Jen, we're all behind you. Stand by Howard Gardner and Jack Beattie. We're joined now by Dr. Marcy Shore Hirsch. Marcy Shore Hirsch is principal at Hirsch Hills Associates in Newton, Massachusetts. It's a boutique management consulting firm, works with banks, consumer products, museums, higher education. Welcome, Marcy Shore Hirsch.
Thank you.
You work a lot with people in all corners of the business world, and I know you've given a lot of thought to careers and career consulting as well. What are you hearing out there? Are people thinking more about their careers, thinking about them in different ways since September 11th?
Well, I think people are thinking about their lives in different ways since September 11th. One of the cornerstones of career satisfaction has always been something that I think Howard pointed up, the issue of alignment. And the alignment is key, particularly around the issue of values. That is the work that you're doing fulfilling the priority values that you believe you hold?
How does that work? Does it mean everybody wants to become a policeman or fireman or Peace Corps volunteer all of a sudden? Or are people readjusting their values even within a corporate setting?
I think people are readjusting, but in a much broader life sense.
Okay.
Not just is the work that I'm doing good work in the traditional sense of contribution, but also how does it match my values around things like time for volunteer work or spending time and energy with my family? People are looking at, in a sense, an artificially raised issue of mortality. Very oftentimes, in career work, what we find is that individuals, when they become aware sometime around middle age that it's not going to go on forever, they begin to think about what they really are doing with their time and whether it's really something that they feel is worth their effort.
So 9/11, in a sense, made everyone glimpse that issue of mortality and apply it to thinking about their lives and work.
Exactly. Now, at the same time, in the workplace, there are a lot of different constituencies, all of whom hold different values. You have workers who are thinking about, what does this mean for me? Is my job safe? Is it a good way for me to spend my time? Does it allow me to live the life I want to have lived? But you've also got the organization. You've got stockholders who are saying, you know, we're in this for a particular reason, very oftentimes to make money. Will the organization be able to do its business effectively?
Marcy Sir Hirsch, what about that? How are employers handling this new workplace environment with lots of people rethinking their lives, their attitude toward work? How's that being handled?
Well, there's a funny sort of dichotomy, almost a schizophrenia happening at work, which is that at the same time as people are more value conscious and thinking about whether or not the work is meaningful and works in their value scheme in terms of their lives, you've got employers who are feeling enormous pressure. Pressure to produce, pressure to have people work longer hours, pressure to lay people off. And there are a lot of conflicts in trying to resolve those two sets of issues because they do need to work together.
Marcy Shore Hirsch, thanks so much for joining us this hour.
You're welcome.
Marcy Shore Hirsch is a principal at Hirsch Hills Associates in Newton, Mass. What do you think? Is it all sounding like a familiar internal conversation to you, or maybe more than that? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. Joe is on the line. Welcome, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. I have more of a cynical view of this. My brother was in the World Trade Center and it was bombed. And, well, he got out all right, though.
Oh, good.
In fact, his whole company got out.
Good.
And the next day he was at home and still in a bit of shock, and he got a phone call telling him to report to work the next day in an office in New Jersey. And so all of a sudden, you know, a guy was in shock and who was suddenly worried about if he doesn't show up for work on Thursday, will he have a job on Friday, has no choice. And so I think it says a lot about the state of corporate America. I mean, he worked at an investment bank, and, well, their attitude was the currency market around the world keeps trading, so we got to keep up. And, in fact, they made him work that weekend.
Ain't that America?
Yeah, you better believe it.
So, is he still working at the same company, Joe?
Yeah, still there trying to decide what he's going to do. Remember, it's not a great market. He's stuck.
It's not a great market, and global competition is a real, real thing. Joe, it's an illuminating story. Thank you for sharing it. Howard Gardner, what do you hear there?
This is really the essence of what we were looking for in our study of good work. Let's say, to use the example that Jack Beatty used, that you're an investigative reporter, mm-hmm. and that's what you really want to do, and that's what you're good at, and you're told you can't do investigative reporting anymore. You can say, well, it's my job. I've got to do it. I've got to pay the rent. I've got to send the kids to college, and who can quarrel with that? You can continue to do investigative reporting, and if you're good enough, and you win a Pulitzer Prize or something, you'll probably earn a little bit of protection. You can try to organize some kind of a counterforce within your organization, and occasionally that'll be successful. But what we're most interested in are those people who say, it is so important for me to do investigative reporting, or whatever the X is, that if I can't do it this place, I'm going to find a place or even found a place where I can do it. National Public Radio, we use a lot as an example in the book because it's an organization which didn't exist 25, 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and there was a real vacuum for the kind of thoughtful coverage of news and music and other things like that. And Margaret Mead said, never condemn a small group of people who get together to discuss something new. Nothing important in the world has ever happened any other way.
You're here.
Now, I don't want to judge Joe's brother, but I do think that people have always had the option in America to say, I've had it. This environment is not right. I'm going to do my damnedest to find and, if necessary, to create a new environment. And September 11th makes it a little bit easier, in a sense, because everybody's rethinking things.
Jack Beatty, we all swell to those words and want to believe them. Do you think it's that easy?
Well, it's part of the romance of America. The we'll light out for the territory, Huck Finn says.
Mm-hmm.
But it's difficult. I mean, if you've got the kids, if you've got the mortgage, if you've got the destiny, you've got to fill the shoes. And what's happened in this country in really since the major change in work I see, I wonder what Howard thinks about this, is we've gone from a position where the job was the locus of security and one could really think about good work over a career to the job now as the locus of insecurity. We have a just-in-time workforce. Peter Drucker says that, you know, corporations built to last like pyramids are now more like tents. And you can't build a career in a tent. It's hard even to think of what good work can go on there. So I think in Howard's terms, the enemies of alignment have never, well, I suppose they were much stronger in the Industrial Revolution when people were reduced to robots. And the promise of our moment is we don't have to be anymore. But on the other hand, the insecurity of employment is just it seems to me it upsets all other values that can possibly go on or be mediated by work.
We're going to have to come back to that, Howard Gardner, after a break. Listeners, what do you think? Jack Beatty says you can't build a career in a tent. Do you agree, or are you a happy nomad in the new economy? And how has the post-9/11 changed your view of that whole economy, good, bad, and ugly? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. What's going on in your working life? Or you can join us online at wbur.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. Have certain careers risen or fallen in your mind post-9/11? Have your career goals changed? Do you want something different from work now? Join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about work and the nature of work since 9/11 with Howard Gardner. He's co-author of Good Work, When Excellence and Ethics Meet. Are you rethinking your relationship with work? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Howard Gardner, just before the break, Jack Beatty was describing jobs today as a locus of insecurity, not security, and putting forward the proposition that you can't build a satisfying career when the desert sands shift so fast. When you're working in a tent, the pyramid is gone.
I think that Jack's comments were probably more true in 1999, the beginning of 2000, than they are now. We've learned a lot in the last 18 months. This goes well beyond September 11th, about the falseness of some of the claims of the go-go economy. And whereas people were talking about building companies to sell, I think that's very passé now. And we're interested in building companies that last. And people are very oriented toward places which have long-term value rather than ones which are very, very chaotic. Also, even if you're in a company which has to downsize, if you've done a good job and you have people who respect you, there's a chance that you'll end up landing on your feet in the next place. If you've been too opportunistic and looking for one place rather than the other, or sort of assuming the job wasn't going to work and always having your eyes out elsewhere, then you are going to get what you deserve, which is a graceless push out and very few opportunities.
But what about this equation of job mobility and obstacles to job satisfaction? Do you buy that? Before or after 9/11, a year ago or now, it is a fluid economy.
It all depends on what the understanding of a company is. I mean, if your company is like a Hollywood studio, and the assumption is you go there for 9 months or for 13 months and then you move on, mm-hmm. and that's the understanding, that's fine. They say we're giving you skills you can use anywhere. Mm-hmm. But if the understanding is if you do a good job and the economy is reasonable, you've got a place here, there's a chance to advance and so on, then I think it's a much better situation for most people. But really, it's a question, this is a kind of alignment. Are people being honest about what the nature of the enterprise is? And that's where some of the new Silicon Valley companies that you're very familiar with were a bit aberrant, because many of them kind of thought of themselves as a production company, getting together, pulling apart, and so on. But that's not what makes most economies run most of the time. And in a sense, it's an artificial model for what goes on in hundreds of millions of jobs.
We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's bring them on. Jack is on the line. Welcome, Jack. You're on the air.
How are you tonight?
We're well, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Like I said, I think that my job has created much more satisfaction for me, because I currently work for the United States government.
In what capacity, Jack?
I develop protective clothing systems for soldiers.
Ah, so you feel a new mission in your work since 9/11?
Yes, very much so. It's become extremely important, the tasks, the work that I do.
Is this Kevlar or anti-anthrax protective clothing, Jack?
I'd rather not get into exactly what I do, but it's protective systems for soldiers.
All right. If you told us, you'd have to kill us. We accept that.
No. It's out of self-preservation.
All right. But do the events of the world really come right into your sense of the importance of your job?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Every day I deal with soldiers that are either deployed or being deployed, and they use the systems that I develop.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's very satisfying knowing that I'm doing something that is going to be assisting them in their missions, and to also assist them if they get into a situation where they actually need the equipment that they're using.
I'm sure that's true. There's the power of doing work that matters. Jack, thanks very much for your call. Andrew's on the line. Welcome, Andrew. You are on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
To comment on your guest's mirror test, I'd say yes, I passed the mirror test. I'm a software engineer.
Mm-hmm.
I work as a software consultant, which means I pretty much bounce from job to job, sometimes as many as 3 or 4 times a year. But I've been very satisfied with this work, and I thoroughly enjoy it. And when I get the opportunity, I do some very good work.
Mm-hmm.
Is your guest, Mr. Gardner, are you familiar with The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand?
I haven't read it recently, but yes, sure.
That's kind of what I'd aspire to. I'd like to aspire to being the Howard Roark of software engineering. But to tell you about
you're a mighty, mighty man, Andrew.
Well, trying. To tell you about my 9/11 experience was that, I was working in the financial services community, provider of market data for a large financial firm. I don't want to say for who.
This is before 9/11, Andrew?
Yes, this is before 9/11.
And was it satisfying?
It was at a time. I managed to increase the efficiency and the reliability of a couple of systems, but in some ways it's very frustrating because some parts of the software community is very much like a star system.
Mm-hmm.
And, if you're not politically viable, at least
right.
in this environment, you
right.
know, they poo-poo your ideas. And unfortunately, there is an awful lot of very bad software going out there. There is a software crisis looming that's going to make Y2K look tame.
But has anything changed in this world since 9/11 for you, Andrew?
Well, like I said, my 9/11 experience was that the market shut down, and then about 5 days later, they were going to open up again. And I came in with a change of clothes and a backpack full of power bars, prepared to stay there for full days and nights to keep the systems up and running. And I even laid out with my boss a notion of, quote-unquote, guerrilla programming, doing anything that it took to keep the systems up and running. It turned out not to be necessary, but we were ready. But then 2 weeks later, they laid me off. They terminated my contract, and I moved on to the next one, and the contracts have been shaky since.
So what do you make of it all?
Well, I've been looking at starting a company of my own, a new enterprise, and I've taken a very jaded view of the IPO, which is I now refer to an IPO as being $50 million you cannot spend and 100 people you cannot get rid of.
So 90s.
Yeah. What I'd really like to see and what my dream has been to have a software firm that would be sort of run like a law firm, but on the notion of a partnership, you know, that you people who did the work, people who managed to make things happen, the rainmakers, as it were, are the ones who end up being made partner, end up being the lion's share. And I've seen a lot of these people, and I've been some of these people.
Andrew, we love it. Our time is running down, but we love your story. We feel your enthusiasm for the chase, and we wish you well in it. Jack Beatty, there's Andrew, the aspiring Howard Roark, undeterred by 9/11 or layoff.
Well, all power to him. The trouble is, though, we live in a Howard Roark economy, which if you're a Howard Roark, fine. If you're just the ordinary person with your ordinary morality, remember Howard Roark was a kind of Nietzschean.
Yes, he was.
It can be real tough.
Howard Gardner.
But one quick addition there. I think that what people think is possible is influenced by when they see examples like Howard Roark or Andrew, especially if they're successful. So while I agree with Jack that not everybody is going to be this Nietzschean character, I'm interested in that large part of the population which could go either way. Either way meaning just hugging your chains and say, I've got to stay here no matter what, as opposed to, it's a free country, I've got energy, if this place doesn't seem right, I'm not going to stay here forever. I'm going to try to change it if I can, and if not, I'm going to try to start a new enterprise. And I'm going to propose for Andrew, we're going to replace the mirror test with the headstone test. At the end of the day, is it going to say he really made things happen or he just had a lot of money?
good. We're all for that one. Howard Gardner is professor of cognition and education and chairman of the steering committee of Project Zero at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He's co-author of Good Work, When Excellence and Ethics Meet. Howard Gardner, thanks very much for joining us tonight. And Jack Beatty in Vermont, look ahead with us here. Do you imagine that employers are going to feel the heat, the passion of employees who want more meaning in their work in this post 9/11 world?
Well, I mean, I don't see how they can avoid it, but they're having to deal with the market as well. And corporations used to be set up to cushion the market, and now they have vehicles almost for directly expressing it. And it makes it very, very difficult for employees. Peter Drucker says you got to treat people now as if they're all partners, which is Andrew's model. But partners on a ship that could go down tomorrow and could downsize tomorrow. And it's very difficult. And it may be that meaning and good work is found more readily in leisure and in social sector volunteerism than in work.
It may be, Jack, but I'm not giving up hope on that on those happy nomads out there who go with the flow and find economic productivity in it.
And make the country grow.
And make the country great. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Max Ekstrom lives in Brooklyn, New York. Back in high school, he thought he might want to have a career in the arts when he got older. He went to college and found his career goals had shifted. At 24, he took a job at a dot-com on the 80th floor in Tower 1 of the World Trade Center.
I was enticed by the idea of working in this building, the idea of being able to get on the train from Brooklyn and get off underneath this enormous complex and emerge above the skyline. These buildings to me were monuments, were symbols of our business ideals. I was attracted to that. I mean, I was conflicted on some level, but probably my family would be proud to have someone working in here, in this building. It was in the summer, It was a really warm day, and I went downstairs into the Trade Plaza where there was that abstract sculpture piece. To me, it looked like a atlas figure holding up the world. And I wrote a poem about it. My poem, as trite as it was, about the U.S. holding up the rest of the world on its back in its colonial capacity, was also a reflection on my own situation as a salary person, expecting a certain lifestyle, and my girlfriend and my family seeing me in that way. And there was a web of interconnected things that I had plunged myself into so deeply that it was going to be very difficult to retract myself from it. And probably if it hadn't been for September 11th, I doubt it, that level of reflection would ever have happened. Like many of the programmers at the firm, and perhaps most of the people at the firm, we didn't go to work at 9 on the dot. I woke up that day to turn on New York One and check the weather. I saw that there was a gaping hole not too far from where I would be working. And how could that have disappeared? It was impossible for me to comprehend. We had no office. And then the company moved to Parsippany, New Jersey, which is about 2 hours commute. So I began writing, and on those long commutes, I certainly had plenty of time to think. And meanwhile, the company was deteriorating. Mid-October, I was laid off, and this was a great opportunity, essentially, for me. I now was a full-time writer. You know, I would go to the library. I sit in a park. It felt like for the first time I'd been walking through a jungle rich with fruit, and somehow I had never been able to appreciate it before. As an entrepreneur or a business person or a programmer or whatever you would want to label someone in the dot-com world, I was impatient. I wanted things to happen immediately. I wanted raises or perks or accomplishments or, you know, the next generation software. And I don't really feel the same way about poetry. If I can write one fantastic poem before my time is over, that would be wonderful. The destruction of the Twin Towers, it was a release from this narcissistic structure that I had built. Maybe on some level I felt that I was an atlas, stuck holding up the world, and that there was no other recourse for me but to continue doing this and continue with my current career and continue trying to make more money. The attack in some way alleviated that. It caused me to basically face humility and say that for me to believe that was an arrogance, because there were people who were committed to their jobs and who loved their jobs and have read these Times biographies that they print of great people who went to a job that they really loved every day, and that wasn't me. And now I'm given the opportunity to do what I love, and I feel I better darn well do that.
Max Ekstrom lives in Brooklyn. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Have events in the news impacted your life personally? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, send us an email. The address is special at wbur.org. You can listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.